I think unless you have skepticism, you're not going to build the trust, because you have to have the judgment to understand if the output is strong or not. The other thing is understanding when to put the human in the loop, and that human having the judgment to say whether this output is strong output or there is an error, and then a way to correct that error so you can have a feedback loop to the AI so it's continuously learning and improving.
Hello, and welcome back to Where AI Works, conversations at the intersection of AI and industry, brought to you by Wharton in collaboration with Accenture. I'm your host, Matthew Bidwell. I'm a professor of management, faculty co-director of the Wharton People Analytics Initiative, and faculty director of Wharton's CHRO program. It's our goal on this podcast to try and cut through some of the noise and deliver actionable insights for business leaders, combining cutting-edge research with real-world case studies. Things are changing fast, so let's get going. Today, we're looking at what happens when AI isn't just assisting humans, but starting to run the system itself, and what that means for the people who have to make it work. Joining me for our final interview of the season, it's my great pleasure to introduce Richa Ranjan, Senior Vice President of Product at Expedia Group. Richa, welcome to Where AI Works.
Matthew, thank you so much for hosting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into the AI conversation, I wonder if you could just share a little bit about yourself with our listeners. What does your role at Expedia Group entail, and how did your career path get you there?
So at Expedia Group, I basically run the platform. So if you see anything that's happening on any of the Expedia properties, it is touching what I work on, basically. I'm also running all of the AI that we are doing from the traveler-facing side. So we're really focused on how can we make it much easier to book, go on vacations, find the right places, and basically just really make it simple for them to travel. I started my career at Microsoft. I was working on speech SDKs before speech was a thing. I won't date myself with timelines here, but it was many, many moons ago. And I was very fortunate to be at the cutting edge of speech recognition technology at the time. I went to business school, unfortunately, not Wharton, but another one at another location.
We all make mistakes.
We do. Spent a few years there and then went to work for Google after his time. And at Google, I got a chance to work on everything from ads to workspace to payments, and really cut my teeth as a product manager in that company, and was working with AI, I would say, far before AI was cool. And that journey led me to Microsoft, where I got a chance to work on multiple products, including Copilot for Office. And that journey led me over to Expedia, where I am today.
Wow. So it sounds like kind of a background that was tailor-made to prepare you for this moment, in a sense, kind of moving through all these tech firms, doing AI before AI was cool and so forth. So did you plan all this out? Do you feel lucky to have landed up in this position?
Yeah, I wish I could say I'd planned out each and every move, but really it's always the problem that attracts me. And so I just kept finding more and more interesting problems at each role I took within each company or between companies. And honestly, I think a lot of career is luck. And so I've been fairly lucky, I would say, to date with both great problem spaces as well as wonderful managers.
So there are certainly some interesting problems that we're talking about today with AI. I mean, I think something you've said is that AI isn't just another tool. It's kind of a platform shift. I also joined this area many moons ago. I was slightly too late for the shift to the PC, but I kind of saw pretty much the whole thing with internet, mobile, and cloud. How do you think kind of AI compares with those shifts? What's similar? What's different?
So I think in each of those shifts that you mentioned, really what you see is that there is some sort of democratization to access for a wider audience than before. So if you think of things like the PC, it really brought compute into people's homes and unlocked a whole set of scenarios. When you look at the internet really made information broadly available. Mobile brought it all into our hands and made it accessible anywhere in the world. And so just like that, to me, AI is a really big democratizer in terms of intelligence and capabilities. It allows people to do things that they couldn't do before. I am unfortunately not a painter or an artist, but yet with AI, I can make logos, I can make images, I can make art out of it. I am not the world's best singer, but using AI, I can craft very cute 60th birthday songs for friends for their special occasions. And so it's really taken what was skills that were once held by potentially smaller groups of people and enabled other people to do it. And in doing so, it's really changed what we can do on a day-to-day basis.
It's interesting. I mean, when you compare it to those kind of prior shifts, you kind of talk about bringing compute into our home and those sorts of things. Compute was something we didn't have before. When you talk about democratizing intelligence, it does feel a little closer to home, or that it's kind of shifting those boundaries between what we do and what we outsource to machines now. Is that very different, do you think, from kind of these prior shifts?
I think there's some similarity. So if you think of the internet, previously, if you wanted to learn about something, you may have gone to a library, right? And a librarian may have assisted you. There was probably a researcher. Yeah. Suddenly, with the internet, you could do that by yourself. So I think there is some aspect of that democratization that existed. But I will say the amount of information that can now be sifted through, the connections that can be made, that part to me feels new. And then the capabilities and the skills that you gain, that feels just like an explosion of opportunity. And so it's unlocking things that you could not have done before. You may not have been able to create that app that you can now host and create a business around.
I mean, where do you think, kind of zooming out on this, I like this way of framing what AI means. Do you think when you talk to your average executive outside Expedia on this, are there things you think they don't get yet? Are there kind of common misconceptions you hear about what AI is doing that you think we need to correct?
I think right now, everyone's really trying to learn as fast as possible. And in that learning loop, I think there's a couple of things. One is, I don't think everyone has a full understanding of what is and isn't possible. When you first start to play with this, you think, my God, this is magical. Like everything output is fantastical. Yep. And then you start to realize, wait, it's not always correct. And so that correctness is critical, especially in business systems. And so that's one of the things that when I talk to people, especially some executives, I'm always trying to explain to them, like when you design with AI, you need to ensure that you have human in the loop moments so that you can ensure that the output is correct. Otherwise, your organization will not build trust with AI and your AI rollout and your AI efforts will die on the vine. So I think that's one thing. What are the real capabilities around it? The second thing I think people don't always understand is the cost of AI. And I don't mean that from a societal point of view or from an environmental point of view. I actually mean that from a dollars and cents point of view. If you are going to democratize access to AI in your organization, be prepared to budget for it and be prepared to think about how do you want to put in cost controls. Sometimes when you put in cost controls, what ends up happening is you end up limiting some of your best producers because suddenly they're rate limited or they're capped on the dollars they can spend. And as a result, you have some unintended consequences. So really thinking about how you're going to do that. And then the third part, I think everyone underestimates how much time and effort and care needs to go into rolling out AI when you're trying to transform workflows. I think a lot of people think it's something that's going to happen magically overnight. But in a lot of cases, the most benefit you can get from implementing AI in your organization is by looking at your current workflows and thinking about how you can leverage AI in order to transform or revamp them, which might mean you're skipping steps. It might actually mean you have a different group of people at the table that need to now do things because AI has taken steps from one place to another. And then as you're doing this, you need to think about where does the accountability lie? Because suddenly you've shifted a workflow that maybe had, you know, four steps with three departments to maybe one step in one department. And so those are some of the things that I've seen people starting to think about. And I think we're still grappling with a lot of that as people are rolling out AI.
Does make this sound like a massive job security program for consultants. I can imagine kind of mapping those workflows and figuring out how to reconstruct them. But there's a lot of work there for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to hear a little bit about what that looks like concretely at Expedia. What are some areas where you found kind of the most gains and how have you achieved them?
When I think about bringing AI into our workflows at Expedia, I really think about it in three stages. The first stage is where the employee is really working with AI and AI is making their job easier. And that's where most organizations start. So things like automatic meeting summaries, right? And we talked a bit about building trust earlier. This is how you start to build trust with AI. And so that was kind of our first foray. We started with this base of meeting note summaries, using Copilot or Glean or some other tool to help draft emails. as we started doing that, we started realizing you need to connect more and more of your enterprise knowledge bases into the AI system so it gets more and more context about your enterprise and about your role, about what you're trying to accomplish. And so as we started doing that, we could shift into a second level, which is really where AI can basically take direction from the human to create. And so what you saw in my organization was my team started using AI to draft what we call product requirement documents. As we started to move through that, we started to see some people who were at the forefront start to create systems using AI. And so these systems are things that can be running 24/7. They're helping making us more efficient. So for example, we get a lot of user feedback from multiple channels. It might be from our call center. It could be from our websites. It could be from help forms, multiple places. And so you could imagine a system, an agent that goes through, looks across all of these different listening channels, aggregates the feedback, and is able to pinpoint the particular product manager that needs to know the information about a bug that might be spiking or about some user feedback that's coming in aggregate through these channels. What you can imagine going even further then is saying to the product manager, the AI system actually giving them, here is how to solve this problem. Here are some suggestions or some brainstorming ideas. And because the system can run 24/7, it's something that's continuously giving information, giving feedback, and helping us improve the overall system. And so as you shift into this third phase, the human or the employee moves from kind of working with AI to directing AI to actually becoming the operator of a system. And so that's where we're trying to get to.
So something you said at the beginning was the importance of some of these tools initially for building trust in AI. I could offer another perspective, which is the importance of building skepticism in AI. And you mentioned that kind of when people first use it, it's like, oh, this still gets things wrong. How do you balance that? And how do you think about risk here? If we want people to take risks, then we need to accept sometimes this is going to result in errors, but some places we care about that more than others. So I'm just curious how you think about those kind of frameworks for deciding when we're going to implement AI, where we're going to use it, when we're going to reward people for doing it, what we're telling people to stay away from.
I think at the base level, as I mentioned, those three phases, right, that organizations I've seen go through. At the first phase, the reason it's the first phase is because the risk is the lowest. There is a very low risk of error if there's a meeting note summary that has something wrong in there, right? So as you build the trust, I think you move up the risk scale as well. And the way to do that is to test on very small implementations, very small flows first, and have the expert continuously check each stage of your output and, again, fix the errors when they start to occur. So the way most organizations that I've seen start is with that base level, very low risk, moving towards the higher risk. And usually what you try and look for is an action reversible with AI? So if AI took the action, can I reverse it? If I can reverse it, great, we'll implement that. If I'm thinking about it's a non-reversible action, we usually hold off on that, or organizations usually hold off on that until much later in the stage when they have more faith in the system that they've built. There is also a need as you're building these AI systems to have an understanding of what the escalation and correction paths are as you hand over more and more to the AI when you're comfortable. And so having those thought out in advance, almost like a pre-mortem of what happens if something goes wrong, I think is one of the critical pieces that organizations should be thinking through as they start working with AI in a systematic way.
Okay, so reversibility, escalation paths, what's going to happen if this goes wrong to manage that risk?
And starting off with the easiest and the lowest risk first to ensure that the context of your organization is correctly captured, right? Ensuring that you have the right systems and implementations in place. And then I think that one of the hardest things to think about is where does accountability lie as you start to build out these systems, especially as they start to cross-cut across different organizations, different peoples, different roles. Where is that output? Who is really accountable for that as AI is making those decisions? Having that defined up front is going to be important.
I'm curious, kind of as a senior leader here, how you think about the messaging to your people? Because it feels like, I think in a lot of organizations, there is, you know, there's huge pressure on everybody to use AI. You know, don't worry about the risks, just do it. How do you think about how much you want to encourage people to take risks, because we need to be on the forefront, versus how much you want to be sending the message, we've got to get this right? How are you thinking about balancing those two?
So I think it depends on where you take the risks, right? And the way we've been looking at this, or I've been looking at this, is if it's not a financial risk, it's okay for them to take it. And if it's not going to be user impacting, it's okay. So we've literally given access to our entire PM team for a number of different tools. Some of them are actually overlapping. And we've said experiment, play, try things out. Some of those things are spectacular failures. Some of those things are spectacular successes.
Yeah.
But in all cases, we talk about it, celebrate it, and we try and disseminate the knowledge and the learnings as widely as possible. I am not at a stage right now where I'm rewarding people for using AI, because to me, it's more important the output for the traveler, or the output, the business outcome that we achieved, rather than
right.
how we achieved it right now. But I think what you're going to end up seeing in the future is that the employees who are leveraging AI and working with AI will be able to have those outcomes faster, and it'll be a better outcome than the employees who won't. So I think they're not today, but I think in the future, there will be some natural selection towards how people are able to accomplish their goals will impact, you know, the compensation systems and things like that.
That's interesting, because you do hear about organizations where it is more mandates and kind of,
yes.
this is part of your targets and so on. So you're stepping back from that because you want people making the right decisions, or?
I think right now, everyone's still learning.
Yeah.
Right. And what was possible yesterday is today's table stakes.
Yeah.
And there's new things possible tomorrow. So I think we as an organization are learning what needs to be done, how we need to do it. We're still building the trust, building the tools, and trying to figure out, okay, I've given you five tools. They all, frankly, overlap slightly. So how can I now pick out the best tool for this job and help you get through that system, or help you get through that workflow with these jobs? That's where we're really trying to push and make sure that we have access to the cutting edge stuff, but that we're helping the employees build it up and work towards a better system.
I'd like to kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about those employees themselves. You know, hear about workflows changing. And it's interesting, some of what you're talking about, kind of the 24/7 monitoring, presumably some of that is just new things that we couldn't do before that now we can do. But also there is some of the kind of, oh, we used to have new people for this, and now potentially AI can do it. How are you thinking about your workforce, what it means for them, how we prepare them, all of those sorts of things? What are the new skills you think people need to be effective in this environment?
There's a number of different things that have changed, and there's a number of things that have stayed the same, right? As I think is always the case. And so the things that have changed, I think the people that play, that are curious, inquisitive, that learn quickly and build learning loops so that they can keep building on their learnings, I think those are the people that are finding it a bit easier to work with AI. So we are encouraging that. I think there are some people who are hesitant or skeptical, or it makes them a little nervous. This is a big shift. It's a big change. And to help those people, we're actually trying to do cohort learning, cohort working, so that you have a buddy who can help you through and help you get to the same point as everyone else. And so in my org in particular, I'm doing a couple of things. One, I'm letting 1,000 flowers bloom by giving everyone access to all these tools. We have a Slack channel where we share what's working, what's not working. People are building mini agents, sharing them out, doing trainings. We do every so often on Fridays, we'll have people come in and talk about what they build, how they build it, and give a hands-on demo there. We're also doing something very structured where for my team in particular, I want them all to have a basic level of ML knowledge. When should I use ML? How should I use it? What are the pitfalls of using it, et cetera? And so the entire team is going through a 101 ML course together, and we've done it in a cohort style. And then finally, the other thing that we're starting to look at is, are there particular agentic flows that we want everyone to use? So for example, the customer listening example that I mentioned, that's something that I would love everyone to use. And so how do we roll that out throughout the organization? So we're kind of taking a three-phased approach to try and bring everyone along to the same point and get us into that future state.
I really like the ML 101. A lot of it seems to be kind of those very experiential familiarity with the tools and so on. I love that you mentioned curiosity as something that really kind of differentiates people. If you're looking 3 to 5 years' time, and I realize that we're guessing, what do you think the skills that people will need to have that maybe aren't so common today?
I think there's a couple of things. One is deep expertise in your craft. So the thing with AI is it's marvelous at creating things. And as we talked about, it can hallucinate. You need to know good from bad. But because it can create so much stuff, there's often a lot of AI slop, right? As my kids call it. And so if you end up in a situation where there is a lot of AI slop being thrown at you, your productivity actually decreases significantly. And so that judgment on the craft side is going to become more and more important. And that's something that we've started hiring and screening for pretty significantly. I mean, we always looked for it, but I think it's even more important in the age of AI. The other thing that I think I've seen people who really thrive is that they're builders. They play, they build, they're actually pushing boundaries, and they're getting their hands dirty. And that is one of the skills that I think will continue to be very important. This has had a pretty big impact actually on my managers, where I really am looking for managers who are player coaches, people who can get into the weeds, who can actually do IC work, but yet can help guide other people and teach them the craft as they're going. One of the other set of skills that I think will become more important because AI democratizes skill sets is that owner mindset. And what's going to end up happening is I think people actually have larger scopes of roles or larger responsibilities because you'll be able to do more and you will be able to do things that you couldn't do before. And so we're looking for people who have that mindset and that desire to take a problem, own it, and solve it.
Interesting. I mean, so I teach HR. So when you kind of start saying we're kind of hiring for judgment, like the place I immediately go to is, how do you measure that? how do you assess somebody's judgment? And just kind of curious, because when you sit across from somebody, you've got to make a decision about that. What sort of things are you looking at there?
I think for the PM role, there are some pretty standard questions around this, around PM skills, PM instincts, vision, et cetera. And so there's standard questions that we ask around, you know, if you had to design X, how would you do it? Or if you saw a dip in your metrics, what would you look for? So it's those questions that we're really focusing on and trying to bring out in the interview. Understand how does the person think? What is the experiences or the lenses that they're applying to the problem that help us answer it? So I think the way that we started asking these questions or started moving towards is very almost case-based in our questioning rather than more, tell me about a time where XYZ happened.
Right. So really trying to kind of see how they respond.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, obviously, one of the things that we're all talking about is often we build that judgment by, you know, that kind of getting your hands dirty. And as technology takes on more and more of that, I think it's going to be an interesting question to understand what the career paths look like in the future that enable people to get that kind of experience. Do you think training for junior people is going to change very substantially as you kind of maybe a less technical, more judgment-based?
I wish I knew the answer to this question. I think we're all grappling with it, to be honest with you. What I have seen is that personal projects really help people get a level of depth or get a level of judgment that they may not get necessarily in the workspace. So a lot of the times we're encouraging people to talk about some of the personal projects that they've done outside of work, because you start to see some layers of judgment building up and you start to see some layers of skills that they might not have gotten in the workplace as well. So I think that is an interesting area that we are very early in trying to explore, but I really appreciate it when you're in an interview and someone starts to talk about, you know, a project they're very passionate about and how they built it, how they conceived it, what they thought about it, you know, if there's a business model behind it, how did they build that out?
Interesting, a different dimension of bringing your whole self to work then.
Very much so, I guess. Yeah.
So just to close out, I'm kind of curious, so this podcast going out to business leaders, any kind of key final thoughts, takeaways, what they need to be thinking about as they grapple with all these questions about implementing AI?
I think it's really thinking through what are you trying to accomplish, right? What is the business outcome that you're trying to accomplish? And then ensuring that as you build towards that business outcome, you are thinking about the system holistically, about your workflows holistically. I think traditionally we've thought about things more in silos and organizations. That's a marketing problem. That's a finance problem. And I think AI really helps us cut across different organizations, different roles. And so it's a different way of thinking that I think leaders need to do as they move towards this AI-enabled workforce.
So not just about the technology, but really reconceptualizing what we do here at work.
Exactly.
To figure out where we put it in. Very cool. That's super interesting. Richard, it's been wonderful speaking with you. Thank you so much for being our final guest on this season of Where AI Works.
Matthew, thank you so much for hosting me. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
So what do I take away from this conversation? It's clear that AI is reaching deeper and deeper into organizations. It's clear that more and more critical functions are having AI embedded in them with huge implications for what organizations look like and how workflows run. What did I find interesting? I learned about the path that organizations are going down as they implement AI, starting with help me in a way that can help build trust with people to work with AI. Moving towards create this for me as people work with AI to create new products, and ultimately moving towards run this for me as entire processes start to happen semi-autonomously using AI. It's clear too that there are huge opportunities here, but also huge risks. AI is far from perfect, and part of the implementation journey is figuring out where we can safely use it and where we can't. This idea of reversibility was an interesting one. What decisions can we let it take and correct afterwards? And the escalation path as well. When things go wrong, making sure that we understand what we're going to do about it. That's all for today. Please follow us so you don't miss an episode. And be sure to tune in next time for a special look back where we'll go through some of the takeaways from this season of the podcast. This has been Where AI Works, conversations at the intersection of AI and industry, brought to you by Wharton, in collaboration with Accenture. I'm Matthew Bidwell. Thank you and goodbye.